This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Mario Ritter Jr. in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
These latest arrests are part of a coordinated and targeted attack against human rights defenders and civil society leaders by the Zimbabwean state.
That's human rights expert Doug Coltart talking about activists arrested by Zimbabwe's government. Also, protesters in Sudan are calling for a million-strong march following a two-day strike to force the military to hand over power to civilians. And a Ugandan activist for improving neighborhoods gains recognition at the United Nations Habitat Assembly in Nairobi. We'll have these stories and more, so stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Sudan's protesters are threatening a campaign of civil disobedience if the ruling military council does not hand power over to civilians. A two-day strike by hundreds of workers in banks and government offices, including the important oil ministry, ended yesterday with little effect. However, a coalition of protesters and opposition groups, the Alliance for Freedom and Change, claims it was a success. Protest leaders called the strike after talks over a transitional government were suspended. Protest leader Mohamed Hassan Al-Mahdi said the protest movement is calling for a million-strong march on the site of a demonstration by thousands of protesters near the defense ministry. The protesters are demanding that the current transitional military council, headed by Lieutenant General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, be replaced. They want a civilian transitional authority that will lead the country until elections can take place. The military overthrew longtime President Omar al-Bashir last month. He is now facing trial on charges linking him to the deaths of protesters. Protesters in Sudan's capital, Khartoum, have been holding a sit-in since April 6th, demanding that the military hand power to civilians. The demonstrators have been sustained through the lengthy negotiations and armed attacks by donations of food and drinks, many distributed by a tea seller, Awadeya Mahmoud. But Mahmoud is no ordinary vendor, as Mohamed Al-Amin reports from Khartoum.
Awadeya Mahmoud begins her day at 5 in the morning next to Khartoum University, across from Sudan's defense ministry, surrounded by thousands of protesters. Wearing a blue top, a traditional Sudanese robe with head covering, and sitting in the middle of a makeshift kitchen, the 61 years old and four young female aides cook up to 10,000 meals daily. The women cook potatoes, vegetable beans, and weka, a traditional Sudanese dish made with dry meat. Supported by donations from food makers, Mahmoud has been distributing the free meals for protesters since April 12, a day after the military ousted President Omar al-Bashir from 3 decades in power. The protesters are demanding the Transitional Military Council hand power to civilians. The military has agreed, but only if it can hold the majority of seats on a ruling council, which protest leaders reject. While the standoff drags out, protesters at the sit-in depend on Mahmoud's support. She says the youth who are guarding the barricades need food and drinks so they can be strong enough to stay there the whole night. The tea and other drinks from Mahmoud and her team are key for protesters to avoid dehydration. Most days, the temperature in Khartoum peaks above 40 degrees or 104 degrees Fahrenheit. Protester Wael Muhammad Abdullah says Mahmoud is not just giving them sustenance, but also inspiration. We regularly come to eat at the place of Aunt Awadiya, the mother of our revolution, he says. She makes everything, including food, tea, coffee, and other drinks. She helps us a lot, says Abdullah, and is here until dinner and sometimes even late into the night. So we really appreciate her spirit of camaraderie, he says. Mahmoud understands the hardship faced by those who take on the power of the Sudanese state from personal experience. She was among hundreds of thousands displaced by conflict in Sudan's South Kordofan region on the border with South Sudan and became a roadside tea seller to support her family. It's not the first time Mahmoud has taken a lead role and been recognized as an inspiration. Mahmoud founded the Women's Food and Tea Sellers Cooperative, which represents thousands of displaced and migrant women who depend on selling tea to survive. The U.S. State Department in 2016 gave her the International Women of Courage Award for supporting women, tea sellers, and other informal professions. An assistant to Mahmoud, Muna Alamin, says she is optimistic that with their help, Sudan's revolution against tyranny can be achieved. We come to serve our nation, says Alamin, and we ask God to help us achieve our goals of freedom, peace, and justice for all the Sudanese people. Despite Sudanese security forces' attempts to clear the sit-in by force, Mahmoud and her team insist they will keep serving meals to protesters until they reach their shared goals, a return to democracy. We came here to help our sons and daughters in creating a new Sudan that we dream to make, says Mahmoud. A new Sudan that treats all of us as equal citizens and gives us free health care and education. She stressed that a new government should support Sudan's poor people, end oppression, drop all laws against women, and increase its female representation. Until those goals are achieved, says Mahmoud, they will keep serving food and tea to protesters. Muhammad Alamin for Voice of America, Khartoum.
In Africa, millions of people are faced with insecure tenure and inadequate housing. But there are examples of communities that are transforming their neighborhoods through innovative, affordable housing and upgrading solutions. Sarah Mandudu is coordinator of Uganda's National Slum Dwellers Federation, which won this year's Community-Led Habitat Awards for Africa, an initiative of the Cohabitat Network, a network of grassroots housing organizations from around the world. VOA's Ruben Chiama spoke with her on the sidelines of the first global UN Habitat Assembly taking place in Nairobi.
As for us, Uganda, we submitted our project called Walukuba Masese Building Center. This was an initiative by the Federation of Uganda through the municipality of Jinja. So in 2010, we identified this settlement as lacking one of the key areas to support the youth in resourceful areas. So this center, in partnership with Jinja Municipal Council, they offered land, and using our savings, what we call the Urban Power Fund, that we collect ourselves as a federation, we constructed this center. This center is a multi-partner center, having the government, the local government, the national government, the federation, those are communities. And so we have now a center which trains the youth in a precast material building, low cost. This gives us a low cost house. And then we fabricate materials for toilets, which gives you a very decent sanitation, which we can pack it. You use it when you're shifting, you can still move with your toilet. And then we have teaching the youth to fabricate other things like welding, molding, solar panels.
What are your key takeaways from this assembly?
What I would love to take as my key take home from this assembly is our government promising that as we go back, we are going to do exactly what we have had here. Because you have been in these circles and we mention good words, we make communities excited, but when you go back home, everyone is silent.
What do governments need to focus on the most? What are some of the urgent needs that you feel African governments need to take as the priority?
What I would say from this perspective is that let government support each and every partner to take forward the agenda they have.
What is the most pressing setback as you work with low-income earners in Uganda?
First, eviction. First, these are people who do not have own land. They are settling on government land, maybe private land. But forced evictions are so massive. People with big monies are chasing away communities from the cities like they are useless. But yet we are all saying the city for all of us. But now we are saying city for the rich. So we are not walking the talk. Forgetting that even this person who is in Islam is earning a living to support her family or his family by small doing this informal business to earn a living. Not only that, they're even supporting you to sweep your office. We need one another.
What is your appeal to the international community and also to agencies like the United Nations?
I'm aware that most of the donor agencies support our government to set up policies. I would expect them to support governments to set up proper policies that really support the poor to undertake their own development. Because there are policies that are generally chasing away the interventions of the poor. I would also expect the donor community not only to look at funding governments. Out there we have organized communities who are even saving and are having some bit of resources, but they only need a little to be added on so that they kickstart their development. And let government send security for the community, because these are their people.
That was Sarah Mandudu, the coordinator of Uganda's National Slum Dwellers Federation, winner of the 2019 Community-Led Habitat Awards for Africa, speaking with VOA's Ruben Chiama in Nairobi. Family and friends of the late Kenyan literary icon and gay rights activist Kenneth Banyavanga Wainaina held a memorial in celebration of his life and works Thursday in Nairobi. Banyavanga died last week in Kenya after a short illness, Rael Umbor reports.
Family and friends of Banyavanga Wainaina, the Kenyan literary icon who challenged stereotypes and prejudice through his writings, held a ceremony Thursday to celebrate his life and work. The attendees streamed into the intimate garden event as the sound of soft instrumental African music played in the background. James Wainaina, Banyavanga's elder brother, spoke to VOA.
How I'd like people to remember Banyavanga, I think, would be encapsulated by just a very brief thought. Ken's life was a seed, and he planted that seed not for himself but for others, just listening to the number of artists who found their voice, because Ken believed in them, gave them a platform to speak in so many different fields, be it musically, very many different types of artistic expression. That's how I'd like him to be remembered, and that's what life is about.
Banyavanga won the Kane Prize for African Writing in 2002. He also founded the Kwani Trust, a publisher that championed African literature by promoting new writing. Billy Kahora, a writer and editor at Kwani Trust, worked with Banyavanga.
I think his legacy is so big that to try and capture it like in a moment, you'd actually have to meet him. You'd have to meet him and kind of spend 5 minutes just to get a sense of what he is like. But I think the other ways to meet him is through his writing. I think because he had so many facets.
Kenyan artist Sitawa Namwalie read one of Banyavanga's most consequential essays titled I Am Homosexual Mom, in which Banyavanga imagines what it would be like to come out to his late mother. A strong LGBTQ advocate, Banyavanga came out as gay through the essay in 2014 and revealed that he was HIV positive. For a conservative section of the society, being gay outweighed Binyavanga's life achievements, but Wainaina doesn't care.
The conversations, everyone has a right to speak. As far as I'm concerned, Ken was an amazing guy. I love him dearly, and nothing anyone says would make me change that.
Kwani Trust is now working on a project to immortalize some of Binyavanga's works.
Some of his work has been put together on a website called planetbinya.org, but I think like kind of formalizing this in a kind of formal reader, this is an idea we are kind of playing around with, and this is kind of a collaboration between friends, family, and we'll obviously be discussing this after to just come up with concrete plans.
Kenneth Binyavanga was 48 years old. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
Despite pledges to pursue a path of peaceful engagement, Zimbabwe's government is clamping down on civil society. Observers say the government is on a knife's edge due to rising discontent over the spiraling economy. Addie Gondo gives us more on the story.
Last week, the authorities in Zimbabwe detained four human rights campaigners upon their return home from a foreign trip at the Robert Mugabe International Airport. Further, state agents on Monday apprehended two more activists, Stabile Dewa and Rita Nyampinga, who it is accusing of plotting to remove a constitutionally elected government through unleashing a wave of violent protests starting from June. They have since been charged with treason. If found guilty, they face up to 20 years in prison. Human rights lawyer Doug Coltart, who was also arrested last month over attending a workshop by the Amalgamated Rural Teachers Union of Zimbabwe, ATUS, believes the arrests indicate something more sinister unfolding.
These latest arrests are part of a coordinated and targeted attack against human rights defenders and civil society leaders by the Zimbabwean state, using a range of methods. The bringing of very serious charges against human rights activists, leading to them being detained for an extended period of time without trial. And in addition to that, the use of state media to denigrate and attack civil society leaders, trade unionists, human rights defenders.
Coltart believes that the ZANU-PF-led government, which has been grappling to curb the runaway inflation and mounting tension because of economic hardship, is getting jittery.
It seems that the state is becoming increasingly paranoid and are just arresting and attacking anyone left, right, and center. So as the economy continues to deteriorate and ordinary people start to become restless and frustrated at the situation, it seems that that this is the modus operandi and the only response that the state has, rather than dealing with the crisis, the economic crisis.
The hyperinflation in the economy has eroded the buying power of citizens, exacerbated by daily price increases of basic commodities. Government has also issued threats to fuel dealers and garages over the overnight spike in the prices of basic goods and commuter fares in the wake of the failing local currency and uncertainty over fuel price increases. After the deadly protests in January, triggered by a hike in fuel prices of more than 100%, President Emmerson Mnangagwa warned that authorities would target human rights groups deemed to be anti-government. The authorities accused the main opposition movement for democratic change, MDC party, and non-governmental organizations that he said were backed by Western government. Dumiso Nkomo, a civil society actor based in Mlawaya, expressed concern over what he termed the criminalization of civil society.
For now, we are still safe as civil society in Bulawayo, but we're really worried about the clampdown on our colleagues. Some of our colleagues in Harare, arrest of activists and shrinking of space in some places. We're really concerned and worried about this. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. So really,
Jenny Williams of the Women of Zimbabwe Alliance believes that government's arrest of the activists is being heavy-handed and unwarranted.
Recent arrests of six activists in Harare for merely attending a workshop to learn about non-violence as an option are being criminalized. Government must immediately release all of them unconditionally.
Amnesty International has added its voice to the growing number of organizations condemning the Zimbabwean government's renewed onslaught on those it deems its detractors. Reporting for VOA, this is Addie Gondo in Bulawayo.
Botswana's president, Moketse Masisi is in the United States this week amid a political storm over his country's recent decision to lift its trophy hunting ban. President Masisi is on a 10-day visit to the U.S. and will attend a global diamond show in Las Vegas. But talk about the hunting ban is expected to dominate much of his stay. From Gaborone, Botswana, reporter Martin Ngwenya has the details.
On Tuesday, Botswana President Mokgweetsi Masisi boarded the country's presidential plane, the OK-1, bound for Las Vegas, the United States. The purpose of the president's 10-day visit is to, among others, attend the JCK Las Vegas Global Diamond Trade Show, where he gives the keynote speech on Friday. This is Masisi's longest international visit since he took office in April 2018. The United States visit comes days after Botswana announced plans to lift a 4-year moratorium on elephant hunting, sparking anger, particularly from conservationists in the West. Masisi says the decision to lift the hunting ban is influenced by the growing conflict between humans and wildlife. The elephant population in the arid southern African country has grown to more than 130,000 from 55,000 in the past 20 years. The president told other leaders during an elephant summit in Botswana early May that it is key for these countries to take control of their wildlife populations.
We cannot continue to be spectators while others debate and take decisions about our elephants. It is not by accident that our region is home to the largest population of elephants.
Some local political analysts urge Masisi and his entourage to take full advantage of the United States visit to address the contentious hunting ban issue. University of Botswana political analyst Lawrence Ogeditse says the trip comes at an appropriate time.
I think it's an opportunity for him to address these different audiences on the same hunting ban. What he just needs to go in there and do is to speak to the conservation strategy that we are putting into place.
Ogeditse says the discussion of the hunting ban has not been handled properly, so President Masisi has to be proactive during his visit.
And he need not wait to be asked this question. The matter is topical and the matter has not been handled as well as it should have been, in my view. The government has since employed an American PR firm to do this for themselves. But what we need to do now is to be in a position to speak to whatever audience we have.
Botswana fears a backlash from tourists from the West, which might hurt the tourism sector, a key foreign currency earner. While in the United States, Masisi is expected to pitch the country's diamonds to the American market and emphasize that they meet the Kimberley Process standards for gems mined outside conflict zones. The United States is the largest market for diamonds, while Botswana is one of the biggest producers of the precious stones. For VOA, this is Martin Ngwenya in Gaborone, Botswana.
Sup, this edition of Africa News Tonight, I'm Mario Ritter Jr. in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all others, please stay tuned for the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Aiden Utku, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.